crusades against the evil of slavery were long gone. In such a rapidly shifting social landscape, the divided Republicans met for their nominating convention in Chicago in June. Feeling less welcome, Douglas, still marshal in the District of Columbia, did not attend. Although he tilted to and fro on some issues, Douglas remained a stalwart and supported a third run by Grant. Indeed, he later admitted that Mr. Garfield, though a good man, was not my man for the presidency. Even defeat with Grant was better than success with a temporizer. In pre-campaign speeches, Douglas had firmly stated his disappointment with Hayes's Southern policy, creating distance from his benefactor. Another candidacy at the convention, seen as an alternative, was that of John Sherman, another Ohioan and Secretary of the Treasury under Hayes, and brother of the famous general William T. Sherman. James Garfield, the bookish, studious reader of economics and spreadsheets, former soldier and Ohio farm boy turned intellectual as well as experienced congressional committee chairman, openly supported Sherman and claimed not to be interested in the presidency. But a less-than-secret campaign elevated him to the top of the ticket as a way out of the morass in which the party found itself. The deadlocked convention broke open on the 36th ballot of a tempestuous gathering of 800 delegates and 15,000 spectators and nominated Garfield for president. As his running mate and as a sop to Conkling and the patronage-drunk stalwarts, Garfield chose Chester A. Arthur, a handsome, man-about-town New Yorker who had never held elective office but had occupied the lucrative position of collector of the Port of New York. For their part, Democrats nominated a more famous Civil War general, Winfield Scott Hancock, the Pennsylvanian who had held the center of the Union line at the Battle of Gettysburg. Hancock, with no political record to defend, rarely appeared in any capacity in civilian life and held a quiet army administrative post on Governor's Island in New York Harbor. He did not cut a dashing military figure anymore. Since the war, a sedentary life had made him a rotund and relatively immobile 300 pounds. Hancock was willing to don the mantles of both white supremacy and reform, while the Democrats ran a scurriously negative campaign against the alleged corruption of Garfield's and Conkling's minions. Neither side had a corner on hypocrisy or mischief in this election, and both proved why American politics in the Gilded Age was such rich terrain for satirists. In Henry Adams' novel Democracy, anonymously published in 1880, the ambitious widow, Madeline Lightfoot Lee, marvels at the corruption she observes in Washington. "What deeper abyss could have opened under the nation's feet?" she wonders as she asks the most powerful man in the Senate his view. "The pleasure of politics lay in the possession of power," answers Silas Ratcliffe. "Here I am, and here I mean to stay." Much was at stake, nevertheless, in an election that turned out 9 million voters, and which Garfield only narrowly won by a plurality of fewer than 10,000 votes. That the Republicans nearly lost to such a weak and uninspiring Democrat demonstrates how vulnerable they were in 1880. Garfield ran a vague campaign. He favored such good generalities as free and unintimidated voting rights, civil service reform by Congress, popular education, high tariffs, and improved navigation on the Mississippi River, while opposing the doctrine of state sovereignty, sectarian, meaning Catholic, schools, doubtful financial experiments, such as greenbacks, and any increase in Chinese immigration. Garfield steered clear of labor rights, a proposed graduated income tax, or any regulation of large corporations. Douglas joined the canvass as a proudly loyal party man, especially in upstate New York, and on one long speaking excursion to Indiana. Undoubtedly, the orator hoped for a second federal appointment out of the new Republican president. Despite lacking passion for the nominee of the party, he knew where the interests of African Americans lay. He had no problem with Republican anti-labor positions. He too opposed unions, especially if segregated, and he enjoyed stressing that Garfield was a genuine self-made man. Given the bold-faced white supremacy of the Democrats, Douglas still saw the Republicans as his only political home. Campaign rhetoric elicited from Douglas a storehouse of wit and sarcasm. He enjoyed few things more in his older years than strapping the Democratic Party to a metaphorical stake and lashing it with an old anti-slavery whip. He was a master of the bloody shirt and the perfect partisan on the stump. As historian Sean Wilentz has argued, Americans have for more than two centuries distrusted political parties and, in a dreamlike, ahistorical fashion, wished for a politics above partisanship. Not Douglas. By experience, from learning through the crises of the Civil War to filter his radicalism through a hard-earned pragmatism, to seeing emancipation and radical reconstruction emerge from a party's aggressive action, Douglas understood that great historical change came when a party decided to step out amid the currents of history and lead. Although it always required some compromise of personal moral belief, there was no more loyal party man in 1880 than the Republican Douglas. If only he could now persuade his party to stand up to the resurgent white South and not treat it with, as he feared, a sickly conciliation. In Elmira, New York, on August 3, 1880, at a West Indian Emancipation Day celebration, Douglas delivered a typical campaign address. The large outdoor audience in Hoffman's Grove included hundreds of blacks. The orator spoke for 2 hours from a prepared manuscript, a formality he employed more and more in his older years. He reminded the audience that at this hour, the 14th and 15th Amendments are practically of no force or effect in the South. The canvas, he maintained, was not about personalities. It was about the merits of parties. Trust the Republican Party and its history, he especially urged the black voters, whatever they thought of the candidates. He did honor Garfield as a man of intellect, devoted to art and science. Douglas made distinctions between the soldier Hancock, who was the product of West Point, and Garfield, who was a patriotic volunteer during the war. Douglas spoke of history, of the war, as a past his listeners must summon. Democrats were the party, said Douglas, of slavery, secession, treason, and rebellion. Their history was hoary with years and gory with crime. They had dragged the nation through war and opposed the abolition of slavery and the enfranchisement of the freedmen in peace. With his black audience, he drew upon biblical sanction. The sins of the fathers descend to the children even unto the third and fourth generation. And lest they entertain any doubts, Douglas declared that each black voter must remember his sacred obligation laid down in his version of Psalm 137. May my hand forget its cunning, and my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if ever I raise my voice or give my vote for the nominees of the Democratic Party. In September and October, Douglas barnstormed across upstate New York and especially in Indiana, which proved in one election after another to be a crucial swing state for the Republicans. At every stop, he presented the election as the same old question of the war. It was national supremacy against state supremacy, the civilization of the South or the civilization of the North. He recycled his old mythos about the free spirit and principles that had built the Republican Party arriving on the Mayflower in New England, while a cargo of 20 slaves with the bullwhip, the chain, the fetters of the South had arrived on the James River in Virginia. Douglas was brilliant at the politics of memory. In some cities in Indiana, such as at the fairgrounds in Indianapolis, he would deliver as many as 3 outdoor speeches in one day. On September 5th, another crowd of 4,000 had to be turned away since Douglas had lost his voice. 2 days later, he mustered voice enough to speak to 3,000 in Pendleton, Indiana, on the very site where he had been mobbed and injured in 1843. Some attendees in 1880 had been there 37 years earlier. The press reported Douglas taking breaks in the middle of addresses and speaking in a calm, deliberate manner. To a Kokomo audience, he told of a Quaker woman named Miss Minnie Trueblood, who had helped save him from the anti-abolition mob of yesteryear. At many other stops, Douglas waved the bloody shirt on behalf of the party as much as for Garfield. He was greeted as an iconic celebrity from the abolitionist past, appearing like a risen spirit in the present. Mr. Douglas arose, and at the sight of his old gray head, said the Madison Daily Evening Star. The cheer that went up nearly lifted the crowd off its feet. It was like the roar of the hurricane through the pines, like the rushing of the mighty waters. Douglas thrived on the cheers and soaked in the roar, but his voice had mostly failed again, and he announced awkwardly that he could not speak in the open. So the old lion said he would adjourn to the courthouse and address as many of the throng there as could occupy the space. He placed his fingers to his mouth and blew a loud, shrill whistle, which stopped and startled the crowd, a reporter wrote. Then Douglas led the procession to the indoor venue. He was so prominent in the Indiana campaign that his image, with flying white hair, appeared up front in a September 29th cartoon in Puck, showing an almost infinite array of people, from politicians to farm wives with babes in their arms, all standing on stumps over the caption, "Great political excitement in Indiana, the whole state on the stump." As an autobiographer, Douglas dwelt at length on Garfield's inauguration in March 1881, on his shocking assassination later that summer by the deranged, stalwart Republican office seeker Charles Guiteau, and especially on Douglas's own place in these dramas. As marshal, Douglas had the privilege of marching next to the outgoing and incoming presidents, ushering their procession from the Senate chamber through the Capitol Rotunda to the back portico for the swearing-in and inaugural address. He placed himself, and thereby black people, at the center of this presidential story. On the day of glory, inauguration, Douglas stressed that he, in his symbolic role, was treading the high places of the land, and because of him, the colored man could occupy this height as well. As before, he reminded his readers that here was Fred Bailey, the unlettered slave, escorting presidents through the U.S. Capitol. These images are almost that of the butler performing his careful duties at the ceremonies of the highborn and the powerful. But he never stopped playing the representative man, which he considered a duty. Although always wishing to be the creature of his own heroic making, he admitted that he, like many others, had been tossed by the late war to the surface. When he turned to the assassin and the issue of patronage at the root of the tragic crime, Douglas left a trenchant, if ironic, characterization of Gilded Age office-seeking. Much of the pomp and enthusiasm at a presidential inauguration, he argued, was both false and purposeful. To the office-seeker, the whole is gone through with as a mere hollow, dumb show. It is not uncommon to hear men boast of how much they did for the victorious party. The madness of Guiteau was but the exaggerated madness of other men. Douglas lived in the midst of this world of glad hands, gleaming smiles, and scheming eyes in pursuit of money and place, and he understood what happened when the cheering stopped. Garfield's brief presidency turned into a macabre spectacle. Douglas could not let it go without a prolonged reminiscence of his meeting with the president only 3 weeks before the shooting, when they discussed the chief executive's desire to appoint some black men to foreign service posts. Most important, Douglas made the best of what was, for him, a demotion from marshal to the recorder of deeds for the district. All those speeches, the backbreaking travel, the sore throats in Indiana, had resulted in what Douglas lamely claimed was a position less onerous, with no social obligations, and more time for writing and speaking. Douglas had likely allowed himself to hope for something much higher, perhaps a cabinet post. No less than Mark Twain had written to Garfield on Douglas's behalf, suggesting such a position. The famed writer had been moved, he said, by the former slave's history. But the recorder swallowed the insult, rejoiced that no black man had ever held this office either, and did his duty. As ever, with the extended family pressing down on his resources, he needed the money, and he did have writing to do. In the summer of 1881, during the drama of the assassination of Garfield and the president's prolonged and highly publicized deathbed watch, Douglas finished and published his Life and Times. Sometime in 1879 or 1880, he had begun work on this third long autobiography. The book garnered considerable publicity and fanfare, even as its sales were disappointing. Otali Asing had offered occasional advice as he planned to write about his life from where Bondage and Freedom had left off in the 1850s. She reminded him of the great men and events in his epic life, urging him to reach for literary fame one more time by writing the sequel of his life's story. For Douglas, the return to telling his narrative a third time was as renewing as it was risky and difficult. Life and Times would be an aging man's summing up of his tale, a journey into and out of his memory. That constant quest in writing to grasp and explain his personal past may tell us much about why Douglas clung so fiercely to his views on black self-reliance, on faith in voting and political solutions, and on forging an abolitionist memory of the Civil War epoch. The memory was both retrievable and not. It was bracing, startling, and had to somehow be harnessed in the service of a narrative about increasing fame and achievement. This search for himself again in the storybook of his life was never as easy to achieve as he wished. In Life and Times, he ceases his description of experience at one point and reflects, "When one has advanced far in the journey of life and has had many and strange experiences of shadow and sunshine, when long distances of time and space have come between him and his point of departure, it is natural that his thoughts should return to the place of his beginning, to revisit scenes of his early recollection, and live over in memory the incidents of his childhood." It was as though he hoped that telling his story once again and constantly revising it might bring symmetry to his life in the present. But great change would soon once again sweep over Douglas's affairs, public and private. During his remaining 14 years, he robustly lived looking ahead in real time, while he also lived as a writer inside the inscrutable, if magical, power of memory. Life and Times, both the first and the revised and updated edition of 1892, has always been at least two remarkable, if confounding, things. First, an indispensable source for at least the last 40 years of Douglas's life. And second, a repeatedly revised, sometimes exhilarating, and sometimes torpid memoir about the accomplishments of a Gilded Age gentleman who conquered some, if not all, racial boundaries, and who rose from radical outsider to insecure insider. On most of the 620 pages, Douglas sought a unity for the theory of the American self-made man. He hoped to make his own life a kind of monument, an edifice so strong that no surge of racism, no embittered rivalry, no lynch mob, no conservative Supreme Court decision, no lost cause, romance, nor even the ravages of time could tear down. Life and Times is memoir as a living museum designed to repudiate the unpredictable fates of America's racial history. Whatever might occur in the future, whatever forms white supremacy might take, Douglas wanted to be sitting there for us to gaze at, his story there as bold refutation. Douglas believed that the United States had undergone apocalyptic regeneration in the Civil War. So too, as the autobiographer kept trying to demonstrate, had he. Hence, almost by definition, after the Revolution and the constitutional remaking of the nation, Douglas could not sustain a revolutionary voice. The quest for freedom had inspired a heroic literary style. The achievement of freedom flattened out the story's trajectory, even the prose. In the self-made hero's autobiographical life, the story of becoming free had always been more dramatic than being free. Or, as the critic Daryl Pinkney put it in assessing black autobiography generally, hell has more and better details. On the next-to-last page of the 1881 edition of Life and Times, Douglas announced that he had lived several lives in one. First, the life of slavery. Secondly, the life of a fugitive from slavery. Thirdly, the life of comparative freedom. Fourthly, the life of conflict and battle. And fifthly, the life of victory, if not complete, at least assured. He had suffered and overcome, he instructs his reader. He had persevered through hopelessness, led his people through the fiery trial, and reached a personal triumph. His story was no longer merely the ascension from slavery to freedom, but elevation to citizenship, to self-worth. In Douglass's five stages for his life, we see his self-image as the lost fugitive risen to racial and national leader, the person and the nation regenerated and redeemed together. These passages are revealing of both the public persona he so wished to portray, the famous man looking at himself as he let others see him, and the private man who believed desperately that he had to live out and embody the image he had created. To some of his readers at the time, and certainly to some critics today, this tale about the fruits of victory can seem strange and out of place. But Life and Times fit into, as it led, the genre of black autobiography during the Gilded Age. William Wells Brown, John Mercer Langston, and many others wrote of their lives in a similar up-from-slavery mode. In varying ways, they all contributed, wittingly or not, to the Horatio Alger mythology of their time. They were, and had to be, success stories wrested from the depths of obscurity and repression. Langston even gave his autobiography the subtitle, Self-Reliance, The Secret of Success. This age of progress required a writer with Douglass's story to be a kind of missionary for success, and therefore to distance himself from his roots and from the southern black folk around whom he found a beginning. In this sense, Douglass built his own monument. But the story he fashioned in his writing spaces at Cedar Hill was a highly revised version of the one he had given the world in Bondage and Freedom a quarter century earlier. The great indictment of slavery and the abolitionist manifesto of Bondage got softened in Life and Times. He tempered his words now, trying to put a positive face on his slave experience when possible. He changed some chapter titles and subheadings as he line-edited himself. A chapter of horrors in Bondage became Characteristics of Overseers in Life and Times. He significantly softened his portrayal of Thomas Auld. In another instance, he changed Oppressors and Tyrants to Our Masters. Moreover, he erased the voices of some other slaves in Life and Times, thus reducing access to the interior psychology of slave life, which was one brilliant feature of the first two autobiographies. And he wrote unflatteringly about the habits of the freed people. Perhaps Douglass was in his own way, as some critics have suggested, using his autobiography to serve the cause of official national reconciliation and progress after the Civil War. He still mustered an old millennial rhetoric in some of his speeches about memory, refuting the ideology of the lost cause at every turn. But as Zoe Trod has argued, Douglass's voice in Life and Times often sounds like that of the complacent grandfather of his earlier self. The richly political text of 1855 survived to a degree in the 1881 book, until he wrote about the post-war years, which became more a catalog of episodes with Douglass ascending the stairway of national affairs. He praised his allies and comrades and tried to settle some scores with his critics, but he really searched for coherence, both with small revisions of prose and with his big themes. At the beginning of the second part's chapter 15, weighed in the balance, he spoke with remarkable confidence. Whatever of good or ill the future may have in store for me, I am impressed with a sense of completeness, a sort of rounding up of the arch to the point where the keystone may be inserted, the scaffolding removed, and the work, with all its imperfections and faults, left to speak for itself. Age, fame, and circumstance had mellowed him. But it is stunning that Douglass, in a life full of such turmoil and fateful turns that might have left him discredited, exiled, or dead, could also write in the last chapter in 1881, "My day has been a pleasant one. My joys have far exceeded my sorrows, and my friends have brought me far more than my enemies have taken from me." He left such passages from 1881 in the 1892 edition, despite experiences that contradicted these sentiments. He needed the symmetry and completeness more than he needed bitter truths. In at least two further ways, Douglass made the third telling of his life very different from the first two. The intriguing choices of illustrations, and the selection of George L. Ruffin to introduce the book. In 1881, he included 18 pictures, 7 of which depicted his life as a slave or as a runaway slave. 6 others are either portraits of himself, the frontispiece, or the famous abolitionists and statesmen he had known. The remainder include an image of his house at Cedar Hill, his role as marshal at the inauguration of Garfield, his visit back to the Y Plantation on the Eastern Shore, a group image of the commissioners to Santo Domingo, and a single illustration of him fighting a mob in Indiana as an abolitionist. But for the 1892 edition, Douglas reduced the number of images to 11, and 6 of the 7 deletions are representations of his slave experience. The only one that survived is the last time he saw his mother. The illustrations in the later edition thus, like some of the writing, de-emphasized slavery in favor of the ascendant great man. The choice of George Ruffin to introduce his new book may seem puzzling to us today, but clearly it was not to Douglas. Ruffin had been born free in Richmond, Virginia in 1834 and moved north to Boston. He was active in abolitionism and the recruiting of black soldiers during the war. As a Gilded Age man of merit, he became a prominent pillar of black Boston society. He was a first of several kinds, which no doubt Douglas found intriguing. First African American to graduate from Harvard Law School in 1869, to serve in the Massachusetts State Legislature, 1869-71, to serve on the Boston City Council, 1876-78, and to be appointed a district judge, 1884. He even unsuccessfully ran for Attorney General in Massachusetts. Here was a symbol of social rectitude, racial progress, and indeed, like James McCune Smith, who had introduced bondage, the high education Douglas never enjoyed. An exchange of letters between the two men in May and June 1881 demonstrates that the author courted the civil servant. Ruffin at first demurred and worried that he could never match the brilliance of McCune Smith's effort in 1855, that he was disposed to shrink from the honor, but that he would assume the duty for its historical sense. In Ruffin's introduction, it was as though he read Douglas's Self-Made Men speech with great care and distinctly avoided McCune Smith's lyrical 1855 essay on the author's meaning to the slavery crisis. Ruffin gave the reader the black Horatio Alger with no hyperbole spared. Douglas was a sui generis historical figure and an American original that could never be matched. He had risen from ignorance and slavery through toil and industry to the status of cultivated gentleman. Douglas belonged on a pedestal, said Ruffin, the gentleman's club president in Boston, and Douglas had a halo of peace about him. Following Douglas's lead, Ruffin declared the victory won, the culmination of his life, the object, emancipation, accomplished. Douglas now deserved serenity and repose. Here was the psychic order Douglas had claimed for himself. In Ruffin's portrayal, the hero need only stand and take applause. But Ruffin could not stop there. Ruffin even, bizarrely, provided some old plantation days imagery for white readers conditioned by the stock popular literature about the Old South and the patriarchal peculiar institution. Colonel Lloyd's plantation was the scene of the great house and the cabins, the old aunties, and patriarchal uncles, little pickaninnies and pickaninnies not so little, of every shade and complexion, from ebony black to whiteness of the master race. Mules, overseers, and broken-down fences. Here was slave breeding and slave selling, whipping, torturing, and beating to death. We do not know whether Douglas smiled or cringed when he read the draft of the introduction, but he chose to include it in both editions. Nothing in Life and Times may have led Ruffin to his sentimental vision of Douglas's rise in social status, quite like the author's descriptions of his third return to the Eastern Shore in June 1881. Douglas had long sought a chance to return to the Y Plantation, still owned by the Lloyds, and on June 12th to 13th, he seized an opportunity. He went at the invitation of fellow Republican and friend John L. Thomas, the customs collector at the Port of Baltimore. On the U.S. revenue cutter Guthrie, They took a 4-hour cruise down the Chesapeake and anchored in the Wye River, just off the Lloyd Estate, where Douglas reported that he could see, for the first time since 1825, the stately chimneys of the grand old mansion. Colonel Edward Lloyd V, the master of the Wye Plantation, former governor of Maryland, whom Douglas had known as a child, was long gone. The estate was now run by Edward Lloyd VII, who had been alerted that the former slave intended to visit. The Lloyds had long been steeped in pro-slavery and then post-war democratic politics, but were also adept at aristocratic manners. Lloyd had hosted Jefferson Davis in 1867, shortly after the Confederate president had been released from prison in Virginia, and two famous Confederate officers, Admiral Franklin Buchanan and General Charles S. Winder, were buried in the Wye graveyard. Each of them had married a Lloyd daughter. To this bastion of the Old South, Douglas, in effect, invited himself. When a note was sent ashore to announce the Guthries' arrival, the senior Lloyd was conveniently gone to Easton on business. His sons, 18-year-old Howard and 8-year-old De Courcy, met the visitors and escorted them on an extraordinary and, for Douglas, nostalgic tour of the great house farm. Gone now, in Douglas's observations, was what he had described in 1845 as the place of atrocities which would make your blood to boil. Wye Plantation was no longer the place of totalizing fear, where Colonel Lloyd would make every slave stand, listen, and tremble, and tell old Barney, who ran the stable, to kneel on the ground and bare his back to the savage whips of Lloyd's 3 sons. Instead, Douglas took a stroll into memory and was deeply moved. Curiously, he claimed to recall the form and features of the Colonel Lloyd he had known 56 years earlier, and he admiringly saw the same aristocratic descent in the faces of the 2 great-grandsons conducting his tour. A careful reader of Life and Times might fairly wonder if Douglas was not declaring his own lineage in and returning home to this family of aristocrats. He was agreeably surprised by how little had changed around the place. Almost nothing seemed missing except the squads of little black children, which were once seen in all directions, and the great number of slaves in its fields. Most of the old buildings were still there for him to remember. Aaron Anthony's house still stood with the window beneath which he used to sing for Miss Lucretia when hungry. Passages from his autobiographies floated in his head, as he saw the old shoemakers and blacksmith shops, or the ground outside Aunt Katie's kitchen, where I last saw my mother. Lyrically, he looked into the old barn, a place of wonderful interest to me in my childhood, for there I often repaired to listen to the chatter and watch the flight of the swallows among its lofty beams. Douglas replaced the pain and loneliness of boyhood trauma now with poetry. The famous man dissolved the choked agony of a slave boy with beautiful, detailed reminiscence. Time had wrought some changes in the trees and foliage. The Lombardy poplars, in the branches of which the red-winged blackbirds used to congregate and sing, and whose music awakened in my young heart sensations and aspirations deep and undefinable, were gone. But the oaks and elms, where young Daniel used to divide with me his cakes and biscuits, were there as beautiful as ever. Young Howard Lloyd and his little brother may have been in awe of Douglas, a reversal the elder statesman may have relished. While strolling through the family burial ground, a place of unusual solemnity, Howard gathered for me, said Douglas, a bouquet of flowers and evergreens, which I carefully brought to my home for preservation. After walking through the still magnificent Wye Garden, Douglas and his small party were invited into the veranda, and then into the dining room of the great house. Sipping wine and sitting in wickers on the veranda, hedged and adorned with fruit trees and flowers of almost every variety, Douglas was moved to write a very personal description of the scene that was at once about memory, nature, and power. A more tranquil and tranquilizing scene I have seldom met in this or any other country. This tranquilized state of memory was in part what Douglas sought in his richly symbolic returns to the eastern shore. He still harbored vestiges of that old rage that needed expending, and mysteries yet floated in his psyche about how Fred Bailey became Frederick Douglass. He craved the Lloyd's recognition and respect. In his estimation, at least, he got it. On his walk back to the boat, a group of black workers on the plantation gathered around. Many were the children of people Douglass had known as a boy, and he called out some of the names of old servants. The author had almost never used the word servant for slave in earlier writings. He spent a little time with these people, and then bade them all farewell, with special thanks to the young Lloyds. The honor Douglass came to seize that day could only be extended by white people named Lloyd. His steamer next took him to the Miles River estate, called The Rest, where he paid a cordial and welcomed visit to Mrs. Franklin Buchanan, the former Anne Catherine Lloyd, one of the surviving daughters of Colonel Lloyd. Proudly, Douglass reported how Mrs. Buchanan invited him to sit close by her side, introducing her grandchildren. She treated him as though he was an old acquaintance and occupied an equal station with the most aristocratic of the Caucasian race. Again, he observed the features of her father in her visage. After an hour's conversation, a little granddaughter presented Douglass another bouquet of June flowers, which the autobiographer soon converted into an awkward declaration of a new dispensation of justice, kindness, and human brotherhood between North and South. Douglass knew better, but these reunions and nostalgic visits to his past caused in him gushes of personal reconciliation that he could feel better than explain. Oddly, he went so far as to state that his pleasant time at the Y and the Rest showed that the war and the slavery that caused the war were things of the past. On many public platforms in these years, however, Douglass argued exactly the opposite. Indeed, he had done so only 2 weeks before his visit to the Y Plantation in a remarkable Memorial Day address on John Brown at Harper's Ferry. In that speech, as elsewhere, he laid down a detailed historical and mythic image of Brown and of the Harper's Ferry raid as not a story to please, but to pain. Brown was a martyr and a victor, but also a classically tragic hero never to be forgotten, a symbol always to trouble and spur the American conscience. Douglass used Brown as a call to action in the memory war with the South's lost cause ideology and with the nation's susceptibility to a sectional reconciliation based on white supremacy. When John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared, Douglass had declared on May 30, 1881. The time for compromise was gone. The armed hosts of freedom stood face to face over the chasm of a broken Union, and the clash of arms was at hand. The South drew the sword of rebellion and thus made her own, and not Brown's, the lost cause of the century. It remained to be seen just who would win this struggle over memory. So powerful, though, was his own story, at least to him, that Douglass seemed to wish against all odds and reality that personal memory might yet defeat the political hold of the past on American society. Douglass took his Eastern Shore flowers from the Lloyds back to Cedar Hill, where they would be no use in fighting the battles that lay ahead. Douglass's conspicuous fame drew enemies and critics at every turn in the 1880s. Upon his return to Washington from the Eastern Shore, he soon found himself embroiled in another press controversy, this time about his alleged practice of nepotism in hiring for the Recorder of Deeds office. Washington, D.C. had several black newspapers by the 1880s, at least one of which operated as a scandal sheet. In June and July 1881, the New South's editor complained that Garfield had made only two appointments of blacks to federal offices, and one is the veteran place hunter, the indefatigable and obsequious Fred Douglass. The other was former Senator Blanche K. Bruce. Some black leaders, implying Douglass, argued the New South, were too ready to forgive betrayal and ingratitude. Worse, the paper blasted the Recorder for hiring in his office his two sons, Charles and Louis, his daughter, Rosetta, Miss Sprigg, another young black woman from New York named Miss Blanche Washington, the niece of Charles Purvis of Philadelphia, and a man named Campbell from the West Indies, who was not a citizen. The New South tallied 4 Douglases, 2 female non-residents, and a foreigner, all in 1 month. Fred Jr. is downstairs in the marshal's office, making 5 of a family in 1 building. Great God. Another paper, The People's Advocate, defended Douglas and his brood, claiming that only 2 of the employees were on fixed salaries, Lewis and a Mr. Shayer, and the rest were paid according to how much work each did. Charles had been dismissed from the census office, losing yet another post. According even to the People's Advocate, Charles was temporary in the recorder's office, but he really needed a job. Members of Mr. Douglas's family, declared the journal in a lame defense of nepotism, have families of their own to support. This paper at least tried to shield the Douglas family, and especially the patriarch himself, from attacks. Frederick Douglass is our most illustrious American Negro, it announced on July 25th. He stands preeminently our foremost man, towering above all others, his character as fixed as the Alleghenies or the Rocky Mountains. Of better educated men we have scores, of men more cultured, more harmonious in their proportions, there may have been, but there has been and there can be but one Frederick Douglass. Many other black men, especially of 2 generations, would dispute that claim the rest of Douglass's life. By any measure, the charge of nepotism was amply true. Douglass's account book for 1881 to 83, a daily tabulation of all receipts and payments to the recorder's staff, verifies that during virtually every week of his 2-year period, all the names mentioned in the press, and especially the names of Charlie or Charles Douglass, Lewis Douglass, Frederick Douglass Jr., Mrs. Sprague, Rosetta, and by 1882, Miss Pitts, Helen, appear on the payroll. Lewis was paid in large lump sums of $25 or $40, and sometimes more. The other Douglass relatives, working as clerks, were paid by the amount of deeds or other paperwork processed in smaller amounts, carefully recorded as $2 or $12.12. Or $6.45. Often the primary breadwinner for her 6 children in the absence of her estranged husband, Nathan, Rosetta had some good weeks and bad weeks at the office. She took home $16.65 on June 23, 1881, $17.80 on July 2nd, but only $4.89 on July 11th. Charles may have only been part-time, but on July 9th that summer, he took home $14.90 and had many other days just as gainful. Frederick Jr. was not on salary, but somehow he garnered $800 for his services on July 20th, 1881. This record makes clear that the entire Douglass extended family lived on the considerable sums made in the collective operation of the recorder's office, all having received their appointments from the boss upstairs. This kind of Gilded Age corruption was apparently standard operating procedure, although it tarnished the reputation of the black first family. The recorder's office was a Douglass family cash cow. The recorder's duties, as well as the demands of the extended family, now kept the sage of Cedar Hill closer to home. So did Anna's health. Anna was finally free from Ossing's summer intrusions by 1881. When Ossing sailed for Europe, never to return. But by 1882, Anna suffered increasingly from neuralgia and rheumatoid arthritis. The housekeeping at the Cedar Hill mansion fell increasingly to Rosetta and her sister-in-law, Louisa Sprague, who had been living with the Douglasses since the late 1860s and had become a close companion to Anna. By the early 1880s, Frederick and Anna had watched and mourned the deaths of no fewer than 4 of their grandchildren by various illnesses, a harrowing fact of 19th-century life. But now, the mother figure of this turbulent but enriching extended family of kin and adopted kin fell disabled. A handwritten note by Frederick Jr. in one of the family scrapbooks recorded a simple statement. Mother Douglass was stricken with paralysis on the morning of July 7th between 6 and 7 a.m., 1882. Frederick Sr. was at home the morning the stroke occurred, and close by during Anna's final month of bedridden debilitation. Anna's room was on the second floor at Cedar Hill, across the hall from her husband's. As Louis, Rosetta's daughters, and the other children of Frederick Jr. and Charles gathered about in a daily vigil, Anna still tried to give directions for household duties. Rosetta remembered that, although perfectly helpless, her mother insisted from her sickbed to direct her home affairs. The orders were given with precision, and they were obeyed with alacrity. Unconscious for the final 10 days, Anna Murray Douglas, a freeborn American black woman who grew up on the east bank of the Tuckahoe River in Denton, Caroline County, Maryland, the gardener, baker, cook, household manager, keeper of financial balances, shoebinder, seamstress, zealous if quiet participant in women's anti-slavery fairs, protector and provider for fugitive slaves, and the unsung heroine who forged the domestic worlds of the great man she married, died on the morning of August 4th, 1882. She was either 68 or 69 years old. The passing made headlines, especially for those who saw Anna Douglas as the paragon of a deeply traditional vision of womanhood and motherhood, and who would use her death to cast an even greater light on the celebrity of her husband. The New York Globe rigidly laid down the gender line, portraying Anna as a heroine of the house. Douglas had spent most of his time in the campaign battling for the emancipation of the race, while his mate made certain that the utmost diligence had been bestowed upon every branch of his domestic affairs. The Globe even quoted Anna from an alleged earlier interview. "My husband is battling with the minions of oppression. Why not I endure hardship that my race may be free? I will do my duty as a wife toward him and our children. They shall look neat and spruce on the street, in the house, in the schoolroom." As though the paper were copying from A Manual of True Womanhood, Anna was honored for her women's wit, for always uttering words of cheer to her struggling heroic husband. In such earnest drivel, the black and white public learned about a woman so few knew. Douglas had time to face the loss of Anna, and he managed to carry on some normal aspects of his work and political life. During the 2 weeks or so after the funeral, he engaged in a fierce personal exchange with George T. Downing by letters in the New York Globe over whether blacks should remain devoted to the Republican Party or engage in independence or revolt. Douglas gave as he took, as usual, demanding that the race not make the mistake of jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, of flinging away the substance and grasping at the shadow. Moreover, he managed a sense of humor on August 21st in responding to a letter from S.W. Cowles, a collector, requesting that the famous ex-slave send or sell him a pair of handcuffs and slave shackles. Douglas wrote back saying that Cowles would be more likely to find such items among former slaveholders. "I have been better known for getting rid than getting possession of such emblems of our civilization." But for some time during and after the period of Anna's death, Douglas seems to have fallen apart. He saw a dawn of hope, as he wrote to old friend Amy Post by mid-July, since Anna had temporarily regained the ability to speak. But to old abolitionist comrade Parker Pillsbury, he wrote 4 days later that Anna was pressing near the gates of death. As the older granddaughters nursed Anna toward the end and helped other women prepare the body for the burial ceremony in the front parlor at Cedar Hill, Douglas clutched his daughter. "Ah, Rosa," he pleaded one day while hugging Rosetta. "If she could have only lived a few years longer." The 43-year-old Rosetta observed that her weeping father seemed to feel that she, Anna, was a protection to him in many ways. Protector, guardian, helpmate, the embodiment of home, indeed, she had been for 44 years. Frederica Sprague Perry, at that time one of the younger granddaughters, remembered that at one point in the funeral preparation, she and other female sisters and cousins gathered about their grandfather, still as mice, wiping our tears away because Grandpa wiped his. "He moaned openly in front of the children," said Frederica, declaring, "Mother was dead. Your grandma has gone away. You have no grandma now." He did not want us to forget Grandma. The funeral was an extraordinarily public affair. According to many press reports, 3,000 people attended, with dignitaries riding in some 100 carriages to the Graceland Cemetery, a prominent biracial burial ground on the edge of Washington. The pallbearers composed a small who's who of prominent Washington, D.C. black leaders, including former Senator Blanche K. Bruce, the famous entrepreneur and hotel owner James Wormley, and the former chairman of the district's Republican Party, John F. Cook. Many of Douglas's aspiring black rivals attended, but were not asked to serve as pallbearers. The funeral sermon, delivered by AME Bishop T.M.D. Ward, was a tribute to Douglas and his abolitionist compatriots, virtually all dead, including Benjamin Lundy, Nat Turner, Denmark Veazey, Richard Allen, John Brown, William Lloyd Garrison, Charles Sumner, Garrett Smith, Henry Highland Garnet, and even two presidents, Lincoln and Garfield. It was as though the bishop anticipated the future eulogies of Douglas while acknowledging the death of his wife. As in life, Anna's husband's fame hovered over, even smothered her identity at her death. Rosetta later admitted, "It is difficult to say anything of mother without mention of father. Her life was so enveloped in his." We have no record of how much Rosetta or her brothers might have wished they could have replaced the good bishop at the lectern that day and reversed the narrative from their father to their publicly unknown mother. Perhaps they let well enough alone, as she might wish. Such a eulogy could be done only in private, and then later find public expression in Rosetta's remarkable memoir about Anna Douglas, My Mother, as I Recall Her, delivered as a speech to the Anna Murray Douglas Union of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in Washington, D.C., on May 10, 1900. Rosetta's daughter, Frederica, set the tone in a preface with a poem, Mother of Cedar Hill. God thought to give the sweetest thing in his almighty power to earth, and deeply pondering what it should be one hour, in fondest joy and love of heart, outweighing every other, he moved the gates of heaven apart and gave to earth you, mother. From Rosetta's reminiscence, we learn that Anna had learned her trade, household management, while first working as a teenage servant in the houses of white people in Baltimore, two of which the daughter actually went to that city sometime in the late 1890s to visit, observing the furnishings and appointments so frequently spoken of by my mother. Rosetta also recalled that her father had taken her back to New Bedford in 1890 to visit the two-room apartment on Elm Street, her birthplace, in 1839, where she could appreciate and imagine the daily toil, the wife at the washboard, the husband with saw, buck, and axe. The economical habits of the Douglas household, sustained over the years, argued Rosetta, were a characteristic of my mother. Rosetta remembered distinctive details that allows us a fair knowledge of the woman so few really understood. In the early years in freedom, near poverty despite all their industry, Rosetta said her father often commented on how Anna would create a nicely prepared supper on a neatly set table with its snowy white cloth, coarse though it was. During the days of anxious worry, while Douglas was in England in 1845-47, Anna fed her children with money she made shoe binding in a linen factory. Anna had considerable executive ability, said Rosetta. Upon the worldly father's return from the British Isles to their cottage, he worried aloud about all the bills that must be due. One day, Mother arose and, quietly going to the bureau drawer, produced a bank book with sums deposited just in the proportion Father had sent, the book also containing deposits of her own earnings, and not a debt had been contracted during his absence. Anna may have remained largely illiterate, but she understood arithmetic and budgets. Anna's domesticity had meant her family's survival. Rosetta saw her mother perhaps as Rosetta saw herself, as a quiet heroine of her gender. While Rosetta was well-educated, her devotion to her disastrous marriage had led to her delivering 7 babies between the ages of 25 and 38. In Rochester, Anna had been called up at all hours of the night to feed hungry fugitive slaves running toward Canada. She set her supper table with extra food for the family on publication day, the time each week when Frederick Douglass's paper came off the presses at the print shop 2 miles down the hill in the center of Rochester. Rosetta portrayed her mother with an acrid wit and a sense of grim humor, but also intolerant of alcohol and frivolity among the former slave population in Washington. Anna was a strict disciplinarian. Her no meant no, and yes, yes, but more frequently the no's had it. Anna did not like social occasions and almost never traveled with her husband, but Rosetta did recall one moving tableau that reveals much. At the spacious house of Samuel J. May in Boston, a major Garrisonian, Anna sat in the parlor when the three giants of the American Anti-Slavery Society, Wendell Phillips, William Lloyd Garrison, and Sidney Howard Gay, gathered around and engaged her in polite chat, as refreshments were served on trays. Anna was usually the one serving the trays in her house. Such a scene in the early or mid-1840s was one Anna likely made sure she never had to repeat. Above all, we can see even in this sentimental tribute that Anna took her role as Douglass's personal shield and gatekeeper seriously. Loyal to her mother's memory, Rosetta had to be thinking, though, of the contradictions in her statement about Anna's gracious hospitality. Rosetta had to sigh about Otilie Ossing when she wrote, "There were a few who presumed on the hospitality of the home and officiously insinuated themselves and their advice in a manner that was particularly disagreeable to her." A better description of Anna's struggle over the years with Frederick's friendship with the German lady could hardly have been written. Charles Douglass also, in his 1917 reminiscence about his parents, portrayed his mother as a woman of unfailing loyalty and sacrifice, the person who toiled side by side with my father from the day he escaped from bondage until the day of her death in 1882. In the second edition of Life and Times, Douglass declared, "It is far easier to write about others than about oneself." He said he had been morally forced to craft so much autobiography, to bear witness for a people not allowed to speak for themselves. But in that 620-page recreation of his public life, Anna was one of the others who received exactly one mention, not by name, but as my intended wife and a free woman who joined him in New York to be married after his escape from slavery. The mother figure at the heart of his home for 44 years, and whose death set him emotionally adrift in summer and fall 1882, remained forever a subject about whom he could not write public words. Privately, Douglass mourned deeply. The weekend after the funeral, he, Rosetta, and his oldest grandchild, the almost 18-year-old Annie Sprague, escaped the heat of Washington and took the train to Rochester to be with the dearest of old friends, the Posts. It had been 10 years since the house fire, and perhaps he and these special women took a stroll out to the hill to walk over whatever remained of Anna's garden. By October, back at Cedar Hill and at work in the recorder's office, he wrote to a friend that Anna's death had caused him a lesson of thought, silence, humility, and resignation. His initial feeling, he said, was to break up my home and possibly go to Europe. But upon reflection, I felt it too late in life to become a wanderer. Had he done so, he might have had to encounter that estranged wanderer, Otilie Ossing. In responses to condolence letters, Douglass kept seeking the language for his loss. In those letters, he expressed a dark, eloquent truth. "Mother was the post in the center of my house," he said to Sarah Logan, "and held us together. The main pillar of my house has fallen, and life cannot hold much for me now that she has gone." Ever since his grandmother Betsy plopped him down at the Y plantation alone as a child, since the last moment he ever saw his mysterious mother, Harriet Bailey, since Sophia Auld rejected him as both reader and surrogate son, when he could no longer sing for food and affection at Lucretia Auld's window, since he lost Julia Griffiths from the daily labor and emotional sustenance of his home and print shop, and since the long intellectual affair of the heart with Odalie Ossing had soured and ended. Douglas had long desperately needed women to provide the pillars and posts in his life. He had needed none more than Anna Douglas, even as he would not allow her